Welcome back. We are joined by Stanislav Krapivnik, a former US military officer born in Donbass and has since returned. So thank you for coming back on the program.
Always a pleasure, Glenn.
So we see only from the last 2 days that the Russians have entered the strategic city of Orekhov in the Zaporizhzhia region, which may indicate that if this falls, that the whole region might begin to collapse. And also in Slavyansk, that is the last conglomeration of Donetsk, we see some real advances being made, which would then, if they succeed in encircling this region, then that would essentially be the entirety of Donbass falling. So do you see the Russian spring offensive having already begun?
It's hard to say, partially because it's still a mud season down in those areas. So you're still more or less in the south anyway. I'm going to talk about Kharkiv and Sumy because they have different, while there's still mud there, it's much more firm ground, forested areas. So it's a different terrain. In the south, you've got the really lots, it's all black earth. And it doesn't have as many trees to fix it with the roots. So you get really, really bad mud about this time of year. If it's as fast a melt as what we're having up here, and it started, to be honest, the temperatures were above zero almost a month ago. I was checking. So they're still having nightly freezes, and during the day they're already well above zero. So if the snow is free melting off, in these kinds of areas, you want to have a fast melt. Because if you have a fast melt, you'll have flooding, things like that. But the ground, you know, the ground's a sponge. It only absorbs so much water. Any excess water, it just sloughs off. And that goes streaming down to the creeks, what have you, and then draining out to the sea. If it's a slow melt, then the ground absorbs its mud. It starts to suck that down into the sublayers. And there's more coming. And it's just continuous mud. So it stays muddy a lot longer if it's a slow melt. Than if it's a really fast melt. Gerasimo, I think I'm butchering his name again. I'm always bad with names. He, the brief that was given by the Russian command, it in some areas it varies a lot from what a lot of the independent mappers have shown. So either there's just been a lot of locations that have been seeing a lot of advances that hasn't been marked off, or there's confusion on the battlefield. And considering this is the Russian high command, you tend to err on their side because you think they should have the right information. The areas that it's under question, we'll see what comes up with videos in the next couple of days, geolocations, things like that. But if to be believed, then yes, Russian forces from the south have already entered Orekhov. Up there's two roads, parallel roads that run up to Orekhov, and there's a long urban sprawl to the south of Orekhov. So they may be already in Orekhov. You get that gray zone because on the one side, the Ukrainian troops aren't saying they're there, but the Russian side is saying they're there. But there's a very normally there's a small difference between the two, but right now there's a big difference. Of course, the Ukrainians also have a tendency of not admitting anything for a month. So sometimes a small difference becomes a really big difference, like they did in Gulyaypolye, where a month and a half after Gulyaypolye was taken, they're still reporting it as the Russians are besieging the city. The Russians are like 10 kilometers past the city. Actually, it was probably about 6 kilometers. And the Western press was just parroting what Kiev was saying. So we'll see whether or not this is the actual Russian spring offensive. I don't know. That's something that, again, it hasn't developed boldly enough to be able to call a big offensive. I mean, as far as a continuous offensive up and down those lines, yes, they've been going on for the last 2 years, steadily rolling forward. Whether this is a big push, you would imagine a big push in this case would still have to have enough armored vehicles, artillery and aviation to support it. I have not seen that yet, but it may be. Now, we know that the Ukrainians were doing a lot of desperate counterattacks in Zaporozhye, not so much because they could take those areas back. They physically don't have the means to do it, but to disrupt Russian preparation, because apparently, I guess they thought that is the location of the big spring offensive. Me personally, if I was in command at this point, I would launch the big spring offensive, at least partially, towards Sumy. And why towards Sumy? Russian forces are about 14 kilometers from Sumy. It's not a big city. It's about 250,000 in the north. But Sumy is a key logistics hub. And Sumy would cut off the Kharkiv area from the west. So you would do a very deep encirclement of Kharkiv, cutting off a lot of supply lines from Kyiv heading into Kharkiv. So that would do a lot of damage for the Ukrainian defenses in and around Kharkiv, and would accelerate the fall of the region. Particularly since you can also cut Kharkiv off in the south, where the Seribryanka runs. If you blow the bridges, so you basically have Kharkiv in a technical, I can't think of the word right now. Well, you're surrounded. You'd have the city surrounded because you could blow the bridges heading in to Kharkiv from the south, and if you have a deep encirclement through Sumy, you take it out in the west, and obviously in the east, it's a Russian line moving steadily forward toward the city of Bryanka and big water reserve, and then from the north, you start moving. There's still Russian movement down. It's been very heavily contested. It has been as it has been, but it's still moving forward. So that, I think that for me, I would do that as the big spring offensive, drop Kyiv out of the map. I mean, sorry, Kyiv, Kharkiv out of the battle map. We'll see, of course. Konstantinovka, yeah, that's a big fight. And that's another one of those areas. The Ukrainians are claiming about 15% of the city is in Russian hands. Gerasimo said that it was around 60%. So that's a very big difference. And Konstantinovka is something that they're heavily contested in. That's the new Bakhmut. It's the latest Bakhmut, let me rephrase that. But they're throwing all their forces that they can into it to try to hold it. Again, the Ukrainians have a bad tendency of, and it's good for the Russian side, of course, not knowing when the hell to leave the party and retreat back out. They tend to really like getting themselves surrounded and wiped out. Of course, you know, Hitler gave those same orders. At least the difference is that when Hitler was fighting, he had generals who he kept sacking and returning, but the generals, they kept sacking because they just wouldn't follow his orders to stand and fight to the last man. They'd retreat, do tactical and strategic retreats as needed. But the Ukrainians seem to be doing the best Hitler impersonation they can and standing and fighting everywhere where they should have been retreating, if they had any sense. Thank God for that. Now, for the north, because that's the south. That's the south to push. And Konstantinovka, by the way, has been split in two. It has the river running down in the middle. All the bridges have been blown about a month ago. So with the water level up, the water is ice cold. You're not getting across. You're not going to swim across. It's very hard. It's very hard to coordinate between the two halves. So you've already split the city effectively, and then you can start splitting into smaller portions to take it under siege or invest it. Now, in the north, where you got Slavinsk, well, to close the gates on Slavinsk, first you got to close the gates on Krasny Liman. And that's a third point where there's questionable how much of Liman is taken, how much of it isn't. Because again, Gerasimo said about 50%. The Ukrainians are claiming about 10% or 15%. So again, you got this big difference. But that's not the most important thing. The important thing is the Russian push in the south of Liman. Because Liman is in this triangle where the Oka falls into the city Bryanka. So you wind up with this triangle like this, and Liman's right there on the wide hypothesis. And then the Russian forces are all around it, and they've closed off from the north as well. But what's the danger to Krasny Liman for the Ukrainians? It's Russian forces have been pushing in the south, and there's only one bridge, one main road left leading up to the Krasny Liman. That's the main logistics road. And that road is already under drone drone attack. The Russian drones can reach it, so it's already somewhat under Russian control. And if they take that bridge, they need to take the bridge. If the bridge is blown, either way, the garrison's not cut off. You're not going to get across those rivers, especially this time of year. So once that's taken, any pontoon bridges, or if they can take the main bridge intact, and you're heading straight into Slavyansk from the north. And that's when you really start to close that big culture. So that seems to be what the developing situation is in that area. We'll see. I mean, Krasnoyarsk is going to fall. I have no doubt about that. It's just a matter of how long does it take? You know, do they surrender? Does it take another week? Well, it'll take longer than a week, I'm pretty sure. Unless there's been major movements and we haven't seen in the geolocations yet, which is a possibility. There's a possibility that's 50% under Russian control. We'll find that out, I think, within the next day or two.
Yeah, you mentioned the Ukrainians not withdrawing after they become encircled, and I guess the obsession with holding on to territory. And you know, it seems irrational, but I think there's a rational explanation. That is, what people often dismiss as PR wars, it's more accurately necessary PR wars, because if the US and Europeans lose interest in Ukraine, then essentially the weapons and money dry up, and then it's all over. So I think Zelensky's become a bit addicted to PR victories, though, which is why he kind of need these things. And I guess on that topic of you know, Ukraine falling out of the headlines, which is something that obviously angers or worries Zelensky significantly. We see that whenever something else pops up and Ukraine disappears from the headline, he comments on it. He argues the need to bring it back, essentially. And you know, so you can't really. Well, it looks as if the war in now the attack on Iran unavoidably will affect the Ukrainian battlefield. Do you have any overview in terms of how significant this is? Because again, it seems to be weapons, there's money, there's international focus, you know, political support, everything, you know, has to, it has to come at expense, doesn't it?
Well, there's one more other point that particular Western commentators aren't too apt to mention. It's the amount of pressure from the military and from certain layers of society that's now been leveled on the government. Look, you know, we don't want to go too fast, or we don't want to hit into NATO because, oh my God, there may be a big war. Iran has shown everybody, including a lot of Russian generals, that, by the way, you can smack the Americans around left and right. If you can absorb whatever hits they have, they really can't do that much to you. And this is a nuclear power, so they're definitely not going to go nuclear, because that means there's no America left. So look, you know, the point is if the Iranians can take out 23 American bases and just systematically destroy them. And American casualties, believe you me, are a hell of a lot higher than 14 guys killed. That'd probably multiply at least by 10 to get something closer to reality. And it's growing fast. And if they do a ground war, it's going to be just a mass casualty event. We'll see. But the point is, look, you know, for 18 days now, is it 18 days? One second. Yep, it's 18 days. For 18 days now, the four-day Trump war has been a disaster for the Americans. Their equipment, their bases that they've been building up for 30 years are getting obliterated totally. Some already are. You get videos constantly of big fires and drones just flying all over these bases, taking out American equipment, infrastructure, and, you know, like it or not, for them, the American military. And the result is what? Not much from the other side. Yes, they've killed a lot of civilians in Tehran, but Tehran's standing. And that's not something they could do in Russia, because U.S. aviation would have one hell of a field day trying to get in. So that's, and the pressure on the government is, why aren't we doing this? When Iran says, we're going after Ukrainian, I'm sorry, they're going after Israeli generals and politicians, and soon maybe Ukrainian generals and politicians. The question is, why aren't we doing this? And that's what the question always comes back to the Kremlin. Why aren't we doing this? We can do this. We have the capability, we have more than enough capability to do this. Why are we not doing this? So that's something that no Western pundit wants to talk about. But if Russia takes the gloves finally off, you're going to see in NATO happening the same thing that you saw in with Iran. Because quite easily, Russia could take out Rheinmetall, or Russia could take out the manufacturers of the Flamingo. It's basically the upgraded V1. Yeah, that's something that you could drop on a Russian account. And there's nothing anybody can do about it except either run away before it hits or die with it. That's the reality of it. Russia could very easily take out these manufacturing facilities. And the next question is, do you really want to go further? Or are you going to back off to the Germans or to the British and so on? I think that would be a shock moment that would cause a lot of these politicians to have to go change their underwear, to be frank about it. Because they've
Sorry, you froze.
Okay, you're back. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you're back. Sorry. You disappeared for like 30 seconds. That's.
Yeah. Okay. So what was the last thing I said? That got recorded.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, something that they don't want to do. Wait a second.
Yeah, you know, there's massive pressure that's building on the government. Why aren't we doing what Iran can do? And like I said, Russia can easily take out Rheinmetall or take out the manufacturer of the Flamingos. And I think at that point, that would be a very shocking moment to European politicians. They may have to go change their underwear after that. Because they've gotten very, very comfortable. They can do whatever they want, evil they want to Russia, sponsor terrorism, do whatever, and the response has only got to be in Ukraine. See? Yeah, okay, the Ukrainians will get it for what we do, but we don't have to worry about it. The moment this all comes home and they suddenly see the smoke piling up from some factory or key manufacturing point in their capital, that suddenly is going to be a wake-up call for a lot of them. That, you know, you've overplayed your game. Things have gotten very, very serious. And look, you know, realistically speaking, America is never going to surrender. Even the smallest cities like Oklahoma City or Arkansas City with 200,000 population in exchange for Berlin or in exchange for London or in exchange for Paris, Warsaw, or any other European city, regardless of size. It's not going to happen. That's just the point of it. It's not going to happen. And Iran is also demonstrating that very, very clearly.
I think that's an excellent point, though, in terms of this also changing the calculation in Moscow, because since the beginning, it always seems that Russia is faced with a dilemma. That is, does it let go? Does it retaliate and essentially restores the deterrent, or does it let it go and, you know, avoid risking World War III, but then of course the undermining its own deterrence if it does retaliate. It just seems that now the ability, not just that Iranians prove that if you hit back, then that's the only way of getting the opponent to respect your security, but it also suggests now would be the opportune time for Russia, because now all this weapons and money are tied up in the Middle East. So again, I'm not advocating for anything, just to be clear, but it seems like that would be part of the calculation here, that this is a good time to restore the deterrence and begin to push back. But do you see any indication so far of Moscow going down this line? Because I heard before that this is a bit of a pressure now, that people are looking towards Iran and asking, why aren't we doing this? Why do we keep getting, punched in the face and not hitting back?
There's some circumstantial evidence. For example, when the French envoys came in demanding that they be part of these negotiations, they were quite literally told to go fuck off in those words. It was the ending of what they were told. So the diplomatic facade there of trying to be civilized is starting to slip away. It's like, fine, you know, these are the people we're dealing with. We know who they are or what they represent in themselves. So there's no point in being nice to them anymore. They're an enemy. Macron and his government is an enemy government. He tries to do this political ambiguity, which Trump is also trying. I think Trump is more doing it off the fact that he doesn't know what the hell to do. And Macron to some degree too. But you know, political ambiguity is not what you want in superpowers and especially countries armed with nuclear weapons. You want absolute transparency as much as you can and predictability. Otherwise, the logic of you know, with America, since America has a first strike doctrine, the logic for any other country that's capable of doing it is the moment you can do a first strike on America, you do a first strike on America. That's the problem with having a first strike doctrine. Oh, we'll take you out whenever we feel like it. Well, everybody's now scared that you might actually be stupid enough to do that. So the moment they see an opportunity, it behooves them in the logic of geopolitics to exterminate you the moment they can, because you're the constant threat. You know, tomorrow I may be having internal problems or economic problems or what have you, and you're just going to strike at me decapitation strike. And since America has displayed, especially under Trump, this fetish for decapitation strikes, well, obviously, if you can do a decapitation strike on the U.S., it behooves you to do a decapitation strike on the U.S. and exterminate Washington or whatever before they can exterminate you. That's the logic that you create because MAD goes away. MAD is no longer there, mutually assured destruction. It's now who gets to push the button first or whose missile can get there before the other guy can make a decision. That's the problem with having a first strike doctrine, and then being having a regime of idiots on one hand and idiots with big grenades and apes with grenades on the other hand, as we see in what they've created in the Middle East, where they literally have no idea how to get out of this and save face. There is no way out without with saving face, and I think they're going to double, triple, quadruple down. So I did a video where I talked about, and tomorrow we'll be doing a video with RT. We're going to be talking about possible ground routes of ground incursion. But as I said, you know, this is a possible route, but you'd have to be a total cretin to go down this route because it's suicide for whatever army you throw in there. And then I got to do it. Well, now I'm not so sure they're not going to do it. I think they may actually go down this route, as stupid as insane as it may sound. It'll be suicide for the guys they tossed in there. But, you know, at this point, I mean, this is a president that yesterday said, you know, not only did they scratch because they made it illegal for all American satellite companies to display maps of the Middle East over the last 2 weeks. Amazingly, it's not just American satellites up there. Whoa! Who could have thought that? Not only the Iranians have satellites, so the Russians, Chinese, a lot of other countries. So the images keep coming. But now, you know, when Trump goes out there and starts talking about, you know, your show, we're going to pull your broadcasting licenses because you're fake media, because you're showing those images of burning American tankers or burning American bases. It's all AI. It's not real. None of it's real. We don't have anything burning. Like, okay. And then it turns around, well, please come help me, you know, open the Straits of Hormuz. It's a very small job. We, you know, you can do it. It's a very small job, which beggars the next question. Why aren't you doing it? Oh, because the U.S. Navy said, hell no, we're not going to send our ships in there to die. So here, Frenchies, Deutschers, come over here. And you Chinese too, or it's going to be very bad for you if you don't do this. It's like, what are you going to do? China's getting this oil. Pakistan's getting this oil. Iranian oil exports have actually gone up 10%. As far as that may be to believe. So you've got a regime that has absolutely no plan. You've got a bunch of psychopathic pseudo heretic preachers in the Zionist Christian Zionist movement telling Trump that he's the anointed one, and to go against Trump's word is like going against God's word. I got a video of that one from was it Pamela White, I think her last name? Yeah, the chief preacher for Trump, the chief heretic preacher. So, you know, that, I mean, these people are insane. They're all certifiedly insane. They got an old guy that started suffering from dementia who's got the big guns and who likes to be, he likes to be praised. And that's what they're doing. to work into his ego. So this is as dysfunctional as you can imagine of the government. And then you got the Israelis, the biggest rogue state in probably the last since World War II. And now what do you do with that? And you've got these two combined. So it's a horrible situation we found ourselves in. And I don't know how to get out of it short of removing both regimes. However, which way anybody wishes to do that.
Yeah, I saw Trump trying to sell in the intervention to open up the Strait of Hormuz, like he was selling apartments or something. It was very strange to watch because, you know, countries do have intelligence services. It's not like, oh, okay, then if you promise us it will be easy. I mean, even Starmer said he had to consult his team, and Trump had a comment like, well, you're the prime minister, you have to consult anyone. So it's like really trying to push an apartment on someone before talking to, you know, your lawyer or whatever. It was very strange to watch. You go ahead.
Trump's the big breakthrough in intelligence and psyops over the last couple of days was Trump calling Starmer a weakling and a loser. And U.S. intelligence is now pushing that Khamenei, the younger Khamenei, is gay. That's your big propaganda push right now. Oh, yeah. You guys are desperate. I mean, that's obvious enough. How do you tell someone you're desperate without telling them you're desperate? You know, just watch the American response. Everything's great. Everything's blowing up. But we can't open the Straits of Hormuz for right now. But maybe later. Oh, and we'll escort him after the shooting is done. They actually said that, you know. Yes, we're going to be escorting him after the shooting's done. When there's peace again and nobody's threatening you. Got it. It's funny and hilarious from one side, but it's very dangerous and nerve-wracking from the other side. Because you're literally dealing with deranged individuals up and down that chain of command.
Well, it was just weird because at some point when the British said they might send some naval assets, to the general region, not to the Strait of Hormuz, the Trump said something along the lines that, oh, we don't need your help now. You know, we already won. It's too late. And now, of course, he wants them to come out. It's just they're so much all over the place. It's very strange to watch the lack of narrative control, management of allies. Shocking. But before, you mentioned Macron wanting to join this diplomatic effort, or I think it's important to be specific. He wanted to join the trilateral Russia-US-Ukraine format. And this is kind of problematic because if he joins as a spoiler, it's just going to ruin the whole thing. That is the desire to prolong the war. I thought that he might have more success if he would just suggest, you know, let's open bilateral diplomacy because... there wouldn't be nothing to lose. If the France and the Russia is able to improve relations, that would be good on its own. And worst case, one creates some divisions within the EU about those who don't want it. So, you know, there's no lose for Russia. But joining in on the disestablished format when the Europeans have more or less expressed their desire to sabotage it, it doesn't make any sense. However, you've seen a wider development, though. The Belgian prime minister said it's time to restore normal diplomatic relations with Russia. This is the same prime minister who didn't want to steal the Russian assets. Even President Stubb of Finland, you know, who's a real Russophobe to, you know, his core, argued at some point we're going to have to start speaking with Russia again. Obviously, things aren't going well in the proxy war in Ukraine, but also... the Iran war, I think, has really shook them because the energy they're cut off from, so the economies will just go south from here on. And security-wise, the Americans are distracted. They have no weapons to send. They have no ability to escalate or bluff, put any ultimatums to Russia, even if they would want to. So it seems Russia is in a stronger position. Do you see any possibility of any, I guess, well, what would be the conditions for Russia to open up any negotiations or discussions with the Europeans, or aren't there any?
That is very, very difficult question because let's face reality. Who do you trust in Europe? I mean, especially coming from the French or the Germans. Let's not forget Hollande, who got beaten to the press only by Merkel to laugh and jump up and down and tell him how they pulled Vladimir Vladimirovich by the nose. And just bought a bunch of time for Ukraine to build up build up for war with Russia, by the way, is what they said. It wasn't just for the Donbass, retake the Donbass. So how do you trust anything that's coming out of those governments? There are continuations, basically, in one form or another with Merz and Macron. I don't think you can trust anybody. And the problem is even these more outlier parties that are now populist parties getting power, like Front National or Alternative for Deutschland, the problem is their leadership is being groomed into being just another party. And it's, you know, as I was talking to a couple of some Germans that I know, they said at the grassroots or the Bundesland area level, you're still facing an AfD that is what it was. But at the federal level, they've been co-opted already. And Front National has been co-opted for quite a long time. And they're the ones they were screaming that, yeah, we don't mind sending weapons. No soldiers, we're not going to send soldiers. But we don't mind sending weapons to Ukraine. So what's the difference here? And then you look at Farage, and Farage is, for all intents and purposes, the rebirth of the Conservative Party 2.0, except he's talking about we don't want immigration. Of course, the Conservatives said the same thing, and you saw what happened in England. You just keep getting flooded even worse under the Conservatives. Everything that else that's coming out of Farage's mouth is neocon playbook. You know, he's just reading right off the talking points for neocons. So again, who do you trust in Europe? You can trust people like, well the Belgians, the reason the Belgians, first and foremost, the reason the Belgians didn't want to take the Russian money is simply because they know what den of thieves that they're a part of. And once everybody takes their share and puts it in their pocket, whenever it gets to that point, there will be lawsuits against Euroclear, and Russia will take that money out of Euroclear offices all over the world. It'll bankrupt Euroclear totally. And then it'll come after the Belgian government in lawsuits. And the Belgian government's the only one that's going to be paying. And Belgium cannot afford $300 billion or euros. It'll bankrupt the entire country, and you can sell off all the... You can sell off the king and queen, and you can sell off all the castles and all the museum parts, and you still will never pay this sum off. And that's the problem. And they're smart enough to realize, yeah, when everybody goes, hey, we're behind you. You know, we're really all behind you, really far behind you, counting the money we just stole. So have fun. Good luck. We're morally behind you. Because if the Belgian said, well, let's sign a document that will split the damages across the board, nobody signed that document. Nobody was going to go for that. No, no, no. You just go ahead and we're morally with you there, but you know, to the end. So it's the EU. What can you say? It's a den of thieves. Each one trying to get over on the other one and climb up the ladder to be the head of the guild of thieves. But that's what you're looking at. I mean, you're not looking exactly at people that have any concept of honor or respect or loyalty. You're looking at cutthroat politics that are unified, but the moment you take away the Russian threat, what are they unified by? Just the lust for power and machinations between each other. I mean, you're not talking about something you can build a foundation of a society on or a civilization. There is no civilization idea in Europe, modern in the EU. There's a civilization idea in the Eastern Europe called Russia, and those that are now being drawn to it, there's a civilizational idea in the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, well, for most of it anyways, but the remainder of Europe, including the Germans and their Middle Europe concept that's been around since the 1880s, there's no civilizational idea anymore. What do they got to bring to anybody? So this is just, it's managers. You don't have leaders in Europe, you have managers, and very poor managers with possible good high-paying jobs in America after they leave. So I don't know, Europe, who do you talk to in Europe? I mean, quite simply, if I was sitting in the Kremlin right now, I would ignore everything coming out of Europe except Orban, people like Orban and Fitzo have proven themselves. Maybe Babich, they would have to depend on how much he can prove himself. But who else do you trust?
I noticed that in Russia, some of the rhetoric over how, you know, the Minsk was a ruse. that it has some similarities to the Libyan issue, because I remember after they fooled the Russians over Libya, Russia took a very different stance over Syria. Now you see, after the Minsk, and of course you could put Istanbul into that same mix, the distrust now towards any real diplomacy, it's quite astonishing, which makes it very, I guess, difficult to find some any settlement. Doesn't mean that settlement can't be done. It just means that the trust component, which is important to make any deal work, is well, completely absent. But you mentioned before the whole idea of the Russians being prepared to take a stronger stance against the Europeans. But how about the United States? Because we've seen some reports in media and some politicians who are outraged because they allege that Russia has handed over intelligence to the Iranians in terms of American targets, which seems quite reasonable. I just assumed that would happen. But no self-reflection. They don't seem to recognize they've been doing the same for the past few years. So, but nonetheless, when Trump was asked about this, he was kind of dismissive. Either the day I didn't do it, or it's just minor stuff like we've done in Ukraine, or they think we've done in Ukraine, he said.
Ukraine, yeah.
But
I mean, what's the major stuff? You try to assassinate the president of Russia. I don't know what could be more major than that.
is the are the Russians also willing to push back harder against the United States?
Definitely, I think so. And the confidence is growing. And even the Chinese, who were took a big step back from Iran at the beginning of all this, have changed their stance quite a bit too. It's true they had their radar systems there, but the Chinese are taking a long step back to see how it's going to go. And now they're looking at it and going, oh, that's how it's going to go. Land lease, when land lease started coming to the Soviet Union, there's a concept called, success breeds success. Well, in 1942, in January 1942, when the British ambassador to the Soviet Union took a nice little drive up to Klin, which is northwest of Moscow. Well, back then it was about 120 kilometers. That's about 90 kilometers. Moscow keeps growing. And he came out and got to see what was left of the smoking ruins of a German division that was surrounded and cleaned and exterminated. And he went back and he telegraphed back to Churchill and to Roosevelt, I think they're going to win. And that's when they went, oh, okay, we'll back them now. It's the same thing here. Here was going back and looking at the Iranians and going, I think they're going to win. They got a pretty damn good chance of winning because, oh, the big bully's come and he's going to take everybody on. Well, when you're the big bully, once you've established yourself as the big guy in on the basketball court, you really don't want to fight anybody because, you can smack around the little guys, but some medium-sized or bigger guy, even if you beat him, he's going to take so much out of you, everybody starts to lose respect for you or starts to lose fear of you. And this is what we're seeing. Yeah, you could kill as many Iranian civilians as you want. The Iranians are clearing the Americans out of the Persian Gulf. And the Iranians aren't breaking. In fact, they're doubling down and delivering blow after blow. No matter what Trump says, Trump's different positions between breakfast, lunch, brunch, dinner, and midnight snack. And you get the whole plethora of what the hell is he talking about today. But the Iranians are standing around. In fact, the Iranians said, we're not asking for peace. They flat out said this. We're not asking for peace. We don't see any reason for peace right now. So they're not looking for peace. They're looking for to punish the Americans and to make it as painful, more maximally as painful as possible. They're looking to expulse the Americans out of the Persian Gulf, and they're doing a damn good job of it, so far, at least from direct kinetic. But they're also pressuring the Arabs to go, look, you're not getting any help from the Yanks. They're not here to protect you. You're the front. You're there to absorb our blows for them, but they're not going to protect you. And that's starting to play a lot on a lot of these Arabs, from what I've been told by sources. The Saudis have told the American bases to, go screw yourself. We're neutral. We're not going to help you survive the best you can. And that's if that's true, that's a pretty big blow. And as much as we've seen Nancy Graham, I'm sorry, Lindsey Graham, just screaming and hollering. I don't know what drugs he was on this time. a couple of the videos lately, his eyes are rolling in the back of his head, and he looks like he's either very, very drunk or on something else. But you know, Lindsey Graham, they're screaming up and down that we defended you and you're not defending us, and the Saudis, you have to come, you're sorry, you know, blah blah blah. Well, it's just, that's another sign of that desperation. They take the mask off and we are trying to strong arm these countries. The countries are going, no, thanks, bye bye, have a good life. You know, what are going to be the reactions after this kind of war is over? Well, things keep going. They've hedged their bets that the USA isn't going to be in any position to do anything to them in retaliation. That's the position that they're holding. Besides, Trump's got his new play toy. He's going to go invade Cuba. That's you know, he's already invaded Greenland, kind of. He's tried to, well, he's got a war he can't win, but he's thinking about invading Iran. But yeah, why worry? We're already going to invade Cuba. So, I mean, he's got his agenda. You know, we've got to do so many things before for the bucket list. I guess that's one more thing for the bucket list.
Since war is always the solution, if one is full of hubris, after Venezuela, then of course, then we have to go to the war. And if one is humiliated, as now with Iran, then, well, we have to change the focus and get a victory behind us, you know, then, okay, well, then it's also war. But either way, it seems to go towards war. But in terms of, the pressure tactics, and it seems as if perception becomes reality. That is, if all these countries in the region thought the U.S. was winning and Iran was on its back foot, then of course they would want to bet on the winning horse. As you said before, that's what countries do. But if you look at this, from Saudi Arabia to Azerbaijan, all these countries which most likely had some false flag attacks against them as well, now they're saying, well, we don't really want to do this after all. That's a good indication, though, of where things are going. And I can see why Russia and China would want to, you know, reduce the U.S. Presence in the Middle East, at least scale them back in places like Iraq. But also there seems to be a wider message. That is, if all the Gulf nations will reach the conclusion that actually being frontline states for the U.S. Will not give us security. It will only ensure that bombs will drop on our heads. This message is going across the world. In East Asia, you have the South Koreans now discussing, well, look what happened. America had some rough times and they took away all our air defense systems. What would they do for us? And they maybe that message... Sorry?
And they did it in the middle of the night.
Yeah, just in case they would notice. But now, you know, maybe this message comes across to the Europeans as well. If the Russians would now seek to restore their deterrent and, drop a bomb on some weapons manufacturers in Germany, what would really the U.S. do? It might, you know, even pull out its air defenses. So it's, I can see why they would want, why there's a lot to gain from, if not a defeat of the U.S., at least some retreat. Just to say, I guess the last question is, what do we know so far about the Russian support, or what do you think about it, as well as the Chinese support? What are they actually doing for Iran?
Well, Russia shipped in. Let's remember one thing. That Russia back in 2005 and even 2004, Russia wanted to sign an agreement with Iran on the level of Belarus and North Korea, a mutual defense agreement. The Iranian liberals who were in charge at that point refused. The defensive clause, I think, if I remember correctly, that's fifth section, third paragraph, went down to something along the lines of from an actual defensive clause that's in with Belarus and North Korea, a solid defensive clause, went down to something: we will struggle together against mutual regional threats. Which means what? You know, it means absolutely nothing. It's empty air. It's just a word salad. That one, when you boil away the extra the fat off of it, there's nothing there. So it's a pointless document. Russia signed that document and ratified it right off the bat. Iran signed that document the second day it was getting lots of loving from the West, because we want to be loved by the West. The Saudis also want to be loved by the West. And when the West was giving it lots of loving is when it finally signed that document, and it's still not much of a document. But what followed afterwards, and the liberals in Iran losing power and prestige after that little 12-day war, and all the mass murders that the Israelis commenced upon inside of Iran, what came out of that was the Russian aid. So MiG-29s, Su-35s, S-400s that we've yet to see, they're being husbanded. I think they're being husbanded for whenever the Americans actually get enough gumption up to bring in their B-52s. If I was Iranians, that's what I'd be doing. I'd be husbanding those S-400s and waiting for the B-52s to start coming in and then take them out of the sky. They're slow and they're big. That's a hard target to miss. So additionally, Russia brought in a lot of technology upgrades for propulsion systems, avionics, jamming. Never mind Russia brought in the jamming systems that blocked the Starlinks and allowed to identify the Iranians and identify where those terminals were located. Let's not forget that. So that's jamming equipment. And a lot of this was for the existing fleet of ballistic missiles and air assets. And for future, obviously, also. Additionally, targeting. I mean, that's what the Americans, they was, oh, they're helping and targeting. Well, why wouldn't they? You've been doing this for 4 years. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. But no, it's not. How dare they do this to us? They're evil. Okay, so what have you been doing for the last 4 years? I mean, either they're that hypocritical or they're that lacking of self-awareness. I'm going with hypocritical. I'm pretty sure they know what they've been doing. They've been bragging about it until it gets done to them. And like, oh, you can't do that. We're the exceptional people. You can't play. It's a rules based order. We make the rules. You can't do that. That's in the rules. Well, yes, we can. Additionally, Russia has been bringing in a lot of its experience with drones. Speaking of drones, there was a sound bite from Trump that there are no such thing as underwater drones and seaboard drones because we would have killed them by now. See, it's all artificial intelligence. And the Iranians posted another one of those drive-through tunnel moments where they're just going down one tunnel and there's a bunch of these waterborne drones. It's just rolls like they've done with airborne drones. Like, okay, it's all artificial intelligence. You know, if it doesn't fit Trump's agenda or Trump's momentary lapse of sanity. By the way, there's something else to consider in this, too. The council, if I remember their name correctly, it's the Security Council of Iran, of Iraq. It's basically a council of militias, of the Shia militias. And what they've said to al-Jilani is, you take a step into Lebanon, and we're going to turn we're going to turn Syria into a new battleground. We'll come across en masse and wipe you out. Plus, you know, he's still fighting the Alawites, what's left of the Kurds, and the Christians and the Shia. So Syria is not a done deal. And I think once the Americans and the Israelis are, either the Israelis are beaten back or they're stuck in a very wide war, as they've now started today, a full invasion of southern Lebanon, the al-Jilani is going to find himself with a bit of a problem because those Iraqi Shia militias are itching to go in for a fight, and Iran is going to be empowered. And I'm sure the Russian military is not going to sit idly by either.
Yeah.
Al-Jilani may very, very quickly find himself from being chopper to playboy to American refugee. His regime is going to be a very short-lived one. It all depends on how much the Americans are left in the Persian Gulf. If they've been eradicated out of the Persian Gulf, al-Jilani's head is going to be rolling if he doesn't jump a plane and take off fast enough. So Syria may bounce back as an entity, at least to some degree.
I've been looking over like all the journal articles and all academic work from 2012 and this era when there were talks about going to war with Iran. And it's interesting that the main conclusions were always, well, this is just a crazy gamble. It's like a recipe for a prolonged war. There's too many unknown variables. If you go after Iran, then that will spill out in essentially every part of the entire region. I mean, this just seems like it was very, very predictable. Of course, what wasn't predictable back then was that they would be fighting a proxy war against Russia, and this also is impacted greatly by this war. So,
They
well,
don't say good.
any last thoughts?
Yes, the satellite imagery seems to suggest that the Chinese are getting ready to return with open arms one of their provinces. So the only one that isn't part of China yet. If you get my point, this is prime time to do it. The Americans are out of missiles. The Americans are jammed up. The Americans are looking like fools. Hey, it's a good time to and they're pulling all their systems out of everybody else. A good time to go look at Taiwan and go, yeah, baby, it's time to come home. So whether the Taiwanese want to or not, and there's a very large faction in Taiwan that wants full reunification with China. So let's not forget that. So yeah, the Chinese may finally see the green light to make their move. I mean, this is gonna have it's having and it's gonna continue to have ramifications well outside of this battle space that they're presently in, and that Trump's advisors were either psychotically, heretically religious in that Christian Zionism heresy, we're going to bring the end of the world and Armageddon and all that, or they were just so bought by the Israelis that they just threw caution to the wind. Whichever it is, I think it's probably a combination of both. They're going to be reaping that whirlwind for a very long time.
Yeah, well, Joe Kent, who was appointed by Trump to be the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, he has resigned now because he opposed the war against Iran. Not only did he say this made no sense because Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, which contradicts Trump, but he also make the point that this only started because of pressure from Israel and the Israel lobby. I mean, this is Trump's own guy, so I think this is really going into the history books as one of the great, great blunders of the United States. And yes, interesting times. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, always a pleasure. I wish it was better of more or happier topics, less more joyous topics, but